evening, and you are very welcome to this week's episode of Let's Go Green here on Midlands 103. I'm Aisling O'Rourke, your host, and each and every week we try to give you some hints, tips and tricks on how we can do our bit to tackle the overwhelming problem of our generation, and that is climate change. On tonight's programme, we're going to be talking about Secondhand September, and we are also returning to the farming community. And we're joined from Chagosk by Tom O'Dwyer, and Tom is the head of the Signpost programme within Chagosk. Tom, you are most welcome to the programme.
Thank you very much, Aisling. Pleasure to join you.
Now, Tom, first things first, for people who are familiar with the work of Chagosk and the Signpost programme, they will have heard of you before, but for those who haven't, what exactly is the Signpost programme?
The Signpost programme is a new initiative led by Chagosk, but involving over 60 agri-food industry companies in a partnership and working together, all 60-odd organisations working together, are looking to help and support farmers in transitioning to even more sustainable farming systems over the next 7 or 8 years. So the Signpost programme was set up to help farmers. It was also set up with a view to taking research which has already been conducted by Chagosk and making that available to farmers and helping farmers understand that research and the implications of that research for their farming systems. So they were the reasons for the establishment of the program, the Signpost program. And as I said, there's over 60 partners. And the final thing I'll just mention is that there's three parts to the program. One is a network of demonstration farms. So I've heard a colleague describe the demonstration farmers as like the leaders in Operation Transformation. So, you know, they're right across the country, and other farmers can look to those demonstration farmers for inspiration. Secondly, we have on-farm research looking at carbon sequestration. And thirdly, and it's in development at the moment, but we expect to launch a signpost advisory campaign which will reach out and engage all farmers right across the country in discussion around climate action.
Well, I do hope those farm leaders are not as controversial as Operation Transformation, but that's a conversation for another day, Tom. So, like, this has been a conversation that I think in Ireland for many years we've been talking about it in the abstract, like this is a problem that we know is coming and we're going to have to tackle it. But perhaps we've not been very good about talking publicly, at least, about what we actually need to do to tackle it. And I know on this programme, we have spoken to farmers in the past about low emission slurry spreading, for example, as one way in which they can tackle it. But like, where does a farmer start? Like, you might be in a better position if maybe in the last decade you switched over to organic producing and organic farming methods. But if you're relatively new to this, if perhaps you may have been wishing that this problem might just disappear of its own accord, which, you know, I know many people have been hoping and unfortunately isn't happening. Like, where does a farmer start? Because to me, it seems like a mammoth task.
Yeah, there's a good number of points there in that, Aisling. Firstly, I suppose to recognise that, you know, farmers, and probably no different to a lot of us, we tend to focus on the immediate, you know, and what's far away and, you know, what, you know, might happen, although the science around climate change is pretty incontrovertible at the moment. But you know, it's still, you know, it there might be a sense of it mightn't happen, or it mightn't happen here in Ireland. So, you know, as farmers and other individuals, we tend to focus on what's of immediate concern to us. That's the first point. The second, in terms of where do you start? For me, I think another key thing is that I think each farmer has to think about their own farm. And not think about what Ireland has to do in terms of climate change, or what the agriculture sector has to do in terms of climate change, because I think once you go down that path, you run the risk of, sure, I'm but a small farmer in County Offaly or County Leash, and sure, what difference am I making? You know, so for me, I think the starting point is, make it personal. Look within your own farm gate and what's happening on your farm, good or bad, and try to identify, I would suggest, with an advisor, what are the options for you to reduce your impact on the environment. And there's no doubt in my mind that there are options for every farm, but the solutions for each farm will be different. So, there's a requirement for a farmer and an advisor to work together and identify the best mix of solutions for that particular farm. So for me, bring it back inside the farm gate to those things which you can control, number one. Number two, the old saying, what you measure, you manage. So can you get some measure of your greenhouse gas emissions currently and use that as a starting point? This is where I'm starting from. Look at the options that are available. There are mitigation actions that can be used by farmers. They're available now, ready for use. So that's three. And then the fourth is to take action, make it happen. And the only person who can do that is the farmer, the individual farmer. And finally, then the fifth step is in a year's time, you look back and see what changed in the past year and whether it was a change for good or bad, and you monitor progress. So that they would be the things I would be saying to an individual farmer listener. Now, to me, there's a whole other discussion, debate about the sector, and what the agricultural sector needs to do, what Ireland as a country needs to do. But talking to an individual listener, listening to your program this evening, I'd be appealing that, make it personal. Look at your own situation. Others, our farm industry leaders, our Minister for Agriculture, they will debate and represent farming interests and, try and secure maybe funding for additional incentives to incentivize change, or maybe lobby for changes to rules or what have you that'll be more favorable to farming. And that's fine, that goes on. But in terms of the individual farmer, my ask or appeal this evening would be: start by looking within your own farm gate. If you're not clear on what the situation is regarding greenhouse gases, seek an advisor and ask questions so that you can inform yourself.
Without wanting to oversimplify it, I think this is the, how do you eat an elephant bit by bit? Mm. And I think you need to start, within your own farm gate, as you say. And I think it's a fair point that if we start taking on, they don't care about this in China or in Chile or wherever it might be, and it can feel hopeless and pointless. But actually, if we all start making tangible changes in our day to day practices, we can see a real impact. So when you mentioned there, Tom, about seeking an advisor, what I would always say if somebody's asking me for advice is, well, make sure you're getting advice from somebody who's qualified or who you know what their vested interest in the topic is. So for farmers, is that a Chagask advisor? Is it a Department of Agriculture advisor? Is it one of these farm leaders in your signpost program?
Yeah, so that again, you'd probably make a case for any or all of those. Mm-hmm. We have over 250 advisors spread across the country. Our advisors are increasingly focused on matters relating to sustainability. In the past, you could say we were more concerned about productivity and profitability. Those aren't going to be any less important in the future. They are still going to be important issues, but we now have to, and our advisors are focusing increasingly on matters relating to sustainability, whether that's water quality, biodiversity, or greenhouse gas emissions, or greenhouse gas and ammonia emissions. So that's maybe one potential advisory source. Many of our partners in the Signpost program have their own advisors on the ground engaging with farmers, and whether through the Signpost program or through those organizations' own in-house training programs, many of those advisors are also increasingly focusing on matters relating to sustainability. Because I guess what we have to remember is that, you know, for our milk and meat processors who are processing our milk and meat, they're engaging with customers who are increasingly demanding milk and beef that's produced in more sustainable ways. Mm-hmm. So they have their own teams that are on the ground and are available to help farmers in making the right decisions, because they have an interest in this as well. As I said already in the interview, Chagas has conducted research. We have a list of mitigation actions that our research has shown can lead to a reduction in greenhouse gas emissions on an individual farm. And I suppose the gap now, or the challenge now, is, you know, how do we work with one another, advisors with farmers, Chagas with industry partners with farmers, and so on. How do we work with one another to ensure that we all move forward together? And I know that might sound a little trite, but, you know, that is how it is at the moment, in my opinion.
And Tom, like, for farmers listening to the show tonight, like, I'm not a farmer, okay? I grew up with, I think it's fair to say, every member of my extended family are farmers. And my father was a late Department of Agriculture inspector. So I have some understanding of farm life. But I don't want in any way to patronise the community, because I know that farmers right around the Midlands and indeed the country are working to do their best bit, have learned and developed and evolved over the past number of years. And we've we've mentioned the low emission slurry spreading. Mm-hmm. What are the other mitigation measures that farmers, and I know Chagas has spent quite a considerable amount of time doing research into this, and in the space of one interview, we won't be able to get into the nitty gritty of each and every one of them, but can you give us maybe some insight into the measures farmers could look into taking?
Yeah, for sure. I would like to start though by echoing your sentiments that it is important that we acknowledge that farming has evolved over the years, and that farmers are already beginning to adopt the technologies that I'm now going to tell you about. However, it is important that more farmers adopt the technologies, and that we see greater progress and more rapid progress in you know, moving towards 100% adoption of some of the technologies that I'm going to talk about. But it is important to recognize that we are seeing changes being made on farms. How do I describe the technologies that have been that are available? So I'm going to use this approach. So the first technology that farmers have to look at is to reduce chemical fertilizer use. That's the first one I think that farmers need to look at. We probably need to reduce our dependence on chemical fertilizer nitrogen by the order of 20%, maybe 25%. That farmers won't be able to do that unless they make other changes also. Okay, so in order to reduce our dependence on fertilizer nitrogen, there are a couple of things that farmers can do. So firstly, they can spread lime, because once you correct soil pH, you can reduce your fertilizer nitrogen application rates by 70 kilos per hectare once you correct soil pH. And a significant proportion of our soils are suboptimum for pH. Number two, you can correct soil P and K levels. And again, okay, the farmer has to invest in phosphorus and potassium fertilizer. But once you have the P and K levels right in your soils, you can also reduce fertilizer nitrogen inputs, and those soils also reduce less nitrous oxide once that fertilizer is applied. And the third item that farmers can look at under this reduce heading is they can look at incorporating either clover or multi-species swards into their farm. And both those options, if you can successfully establish clover or multi-species spores, you can significantly reduce your use of chemical fertilizer nitrogen. All those actions, if you can make them work, if you can optimize them for your farm, yes, there will be some investment in terms of lime and phosphorus and potassium fertilizer, But there could be significant savings for the farmer in terms of fertilizer nitrogen usage. And given the price of fertilizer nitrogen this year, that saving is a multiple of what it would have been just 12 months ago. So the economic argument for, addressing low soil pH, low soil P and K, not looking at clover as an option, the economic argument for ignoring that is sorry for t sorry for taking action on that is even more compelling now than what it was a year ago. So that's reduce. The second one is to replace, and what I mean by that is we will still have to use fertilizer nitrogen. It will not be possible for Ireland to produce the amount of milk and beef that it currently does, with zero fertilizer nitrogen. And it is important that as a country we continue to produce the healthy, nutritious food that we're recognized for. So in terms of replace, then for the remaining fertilizer nitrogen that as a farmer you're going to use, our research indicates that if you use protected urea rather than calcium ammonium nitrate or straight urea, you can have a significant reduction effect on greenhouse gas and ammonia emissions. So we're very strongly recommending farmers choose protected urea as their fertilizer nitrogen source. So that's reduce, replace, and the third one then is to recycle. And by recycling, what I mean is it's the recycle of nutrients in animal manures. So that's about using the correct application technology. You've already mentioned it yourself, the low emission slurry spreading, but also it's the timing of application, it's the rate of application, it's where you apply the slurry. So those sorts of decisions are important as well. So reduce, replace, recycle.
There's a lot in there. Is it reduce, replace, recycle? Could you take, say, right, we've got what, 3 and a bit months left in 2020? Can you break them up and say, okay, for now, reduce is what I'm focusing on for the next, between now and the end of the year? Or do they need to be done together?
No, they don't need to be done together. And we had a major open day in Johnstown Castle last week. And one of the messages we were giving out on that day is rather than, feeling overwhelmed by the entire list of activities that you could do or the changes that you could make on your farm, identify one or two that you can do something about in the next 3.5 months or 6 months, but put a reasonable time frame on it and say, yeah, in the next 6 months, this is what I'm going to change. I'm going to make one change. And then after that period, come back and look again and say, I'm going to go after this one. Because I think, what we all need to remember, and again, sometimes it can feel a little trite to say it, but we need to make progress rather than achieve perfection, by the end of the year. So we need to make progress. That to me, that's the main thing. And if we can change, if every farmer could make one change, that would be progress. If every farmer makes another change next year, that's further progress. And I guess the other thing that we have to bear in mind is that as we're getting closer to 2030 and passing by 2030, the narrative will change to climate neutrality by 2050. So 2030 is but a destination on the journey to 2050. And I think you said earlier in the interview, Aisling, that farmers are changing and are evolving and have evolved. Absolutely agree with you. So I suspect that farming in 2050, well, in 2030, and again in 2050 will look different to how it looks today. But it won't be a kind of a flick of the switch, and it'll just change from the way it is now to the way it is in 2030. And it'll all happen, at midnight on the 31st of December, 2029. That's not the way it's going to be. It's going to be an evolution over the next 7 or 8 years. And that evolution is, in my mind, is going to continue beyond 2030. So, yeah, sorry. S short answer to your question, identify one action. If I was to pick one, I'd probably pick looking at soil pH, so taking soil samples this autumn. establish what the soil pH is, and then take action to apply lime if lime is required. That would be one. And the second one I probably would look at when planning for fertilizer for 2023, that I'm thinking that as a farmer, I'm thinking in terms of protected urea as my nitrogen source. There's an economic benefit. It's going to cost you less per kilo of nitrogen, and there's also an environmental benefit. So they would be probably my two priorities.
Well, Tom O'Dwyer, head of the Signpost Programme at Chagas, as I say, there is so much to discuss. This is a large issue that we all have to face. And you know, Tom, it's not going to be like when we switched from the punt to the euro. It's not going to happen at the stroke of midnight. We have to start today and make changes little by little. Thank you very much for your time on Let's Go Green this evening.
Thank you, Aisling.
We will be back after the break. You're listening to Let's Go Green here on Midlands 103, and I hope you enjoyed our conversation earlier this evening with Tom O'Dwyer of Chagasks. Tom is working on that particular campaign for those involved in the farm sector on how you can do your bit and how you can navigate the overwhelming job that we all face in reducing our carbon emissions. And once again, it is worth your while contacting Chagas to have a conversation with Tom and his colleagues and to find your local advisor on sustainability issues in your area. You can get in contact with them through the chagas.ie website. I wanted to take a moment to remind you that Let's Go Green, like other shows here on Midlands 103, is a podcast in and of its own right. So if perhaps of an evening you've got an appointment that means you can't sit down at home and enjoy Let's Go Green, you can catch up on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, and of course on Spotify. Please do like, subscribe, or even write a review and share the podcast links with your family and friends. Every link does help, so we would very much appreciate it. And those Apple reviews are always, they're always nice to see. So if you want to do that for us here on Midlands 103, I know I and everyone else on air would appreciate it. We're going to take a short break. Before we do, on our next item, we're talking about secondhand September. And, you know, this is a month when we're being asked not to buy anything new. How feasible is that, do you think? We're going to find out after the break. And welcome back. You're listening to Let's Go Green here on Midlands 103. And this evening we're joined now by Lindsay O'Connell. Now, Lindsay is from Voice Ireland. And Lindsay, I know we've spoken to your colleagues about different aspects of the work that Voice is involved with. But just for our listeners' memories, just remind us, first of all, welcome to the show. But remind us, what is it that Voice does?
Yeah, so it's lovely to talk to you, Aisling. Thank you for having us on. So Voice is an environmental charity, and we've been going for 25 years, actually. It's our anniversary this year. And all of our campaigns and our policy work is focused on one thing in particular, and that's reducing waste. So trying to move Ireland from a kind of a, you know, make waste culture into a more circular economy,
basically. Now, we on last week's show, we were talking to Dr. Aoife Long about sustainable fashion brands in Ireland and labels that are making clothing out of wool and fabrics made and designed here in Ireland. And to continue on that kind of sustainability in relation to fashion conversation, Voice, this month you are supporting Secondhand September. So what is Secondhand September?
Yeah, Aisling, it's just as the name suggests. So it was set up by Oxfam a few years ago, and it's a campaign that highlights the many problems that we have around fast fashion. And it asks us to take an action. So it asks us to kind of get into the mindset of reusing our materials, or if we're going out to buy something, maybe try and buy it secondhand. So the campaign was started, like I said, a few years ago, and it is focused on fast fashion. But there has been such a popularity around it that it's grown into other factors and other industries as well. So we've been asking people to maybe move away from buying first fashion clothing and into other things as well, like appliances, home appliances and things like that as well. So the campaign, where it started very small, has actually grown huge legs.
And we're big supporters of it. As you rightly say there, like, I know people in my own family who love antiquing, I think is the term. And, you know, and it's their hobby, it's their passion. I know when I was lucky enough to buy my own home in 2020, I went off to some vintage shops to buy, you know, my dresser and my sideboard, because, well, first of all, it was in budget and I liked the style, I have to be honest. But like, there are, it's not just kind of a negative thing that we're trying to, like, you know, say that fast fashion is this horrible thing and this evil thing and it's causing all these problems, which we know it is causing problems. But actually, there's some things, there's a whole market out there that we don't really think of when we're going to buy appliances or home decor and clothing. Somehow it has kind of escaped our heads, I think, for a lot of us in our everyday shopping.
That's so true. And we're not talking about anything new here. We're not reinventing any wheels. This is something that the Irish people did and a lot of all around the world did a long time ago. And it's only since the Second World War that we've really looked on items as being disposable and single use. So what we're trying to do is just bring back that sense of kind of imagination when it comes to people shopping. Like you say, if you're going antiquing, you have to have a good eye about you. You know, you're not going online, you're not subscribing to any trends where you're being fed the latest thing that's in vogue. You're actually using your own sense of style. And we're encouraging people to go back to that kind of thrifty mindset and to be reusey and to be a reuser, basically. So if we think about all of the materials that we see out there, they all have a carbon footprint. And that's like anything from a typewriter to a jumper to your dancing shoes that you wear on Saturday night. And this carbon footprint is, you know, there's a lot of water that goes into making those items, transportation, all of those different factors. And if we reuse that item as many times as possible, and then when it breaks, we try and fix it and try and keep it going for as long as possible, we keep it circular and we keep it in the circular economy. So it's about getting the benefit from all of those materials as well, because we're putting pressure on our environment, we're taking those natural materials, we're using them, and we're adding into the carbon into the environment by making things. So what we're trying to say to people is, if you're going to use it, try and reuse it. If it's broken, try and fix it. And if you're going out to buy something, ask yourself, is there a charity shop? Is there a secondhand appliance store near me? Or like you say, is there an antique store near me that where I could go buy something that's maybe not on trend, but is way more stylish?
I am an Oxley woman from Tullamore, and Tullamore in recent years, the charity shop scene has just exploded. We have, we seem to have loads of them in Tullamore, and I suppose it's about getting us into, and they're all for different charities and different organisations who all do wonderful work locally in the community. And I know, and I'm just highlighting Tullamore because it's what I'm familiar with. I know in many towns right across the Midlands there are fantastic antiques and secondhand and charity shops. There is still, I think maybe in a certain age group, maybe a little bit of a snobbery factor about going in. I think people, even younger than I am, are much more comfortable in going in charity shopping because we see YouTubers, influencers doing all these things on social media all the time. It's been normalised. But I know for maybe an older generation, you only did that when you were financially stuck and there's a bit of a stigma attached.
I agree. I really agree. And to be honest with you, when I started on my reuse journey when I was younger, I might have had that impression of charity shops before. But like you say, they've changed and they've grown. And there is a huge move towards reuse now and secondhand. So not only is the quality of the items in the secondhand shops much higher than they were previously, and you're able to have a better access, better range of products. So you could walk into a charity shop and there's glassware. There is shoes that have never been worn before. There is clothing that still have the original tags on them. And they're very high quality. For example, I'm only going from personal stories as well. I bought a secondhand full-length wool coat in a charity shop in Clontarf in Dublin last winter. And when I looked up online, it was worth over €900 and I bought it for €40. So I think what I would say to people who maybe are a little bit kind of wary about going to a charity shop, don't go in with any expectations. Just go in and see, is there anything there that maybe you're interested in? And pop in every so often, because one of the big things I find with the challenges with charity shopping, and you probably agree with me, Aisling, is that if you go in with an idea in mind of what you want, so I want a three-seater sofa, or I want, you know, champagne glasses, you're not going to find them. It's all about stopping in whenever you're passing and just having a look and see if there's something there. And maybe there's something there's not, but it's those little gems that you find were a huge game changer.
And I think as well, like, I know I'm not the smallest of ladies, and like I have given recently, I did a clear out over the summer, and a particular charity shop in Tullamore got a bunch of ball gowns that I was never going to fit into ever again. So I decided, you know what, why are they sitting gathering dust in my wardrobe? So like, it's, and I'm saying that not to make me sound like I'm wonderful or anything like that, but because I would have had a fear a number of years ago of, well, they only have clothing for a certain size of woman. They don't have a broad range. Whereas as more of us contribute to the market, actually there is huge diversity in what you can get.
That's right. Okay, so that's the, you've made such a brilliant point. Apart from, I have so many questions to you, Aisling. Number one, why are you going to so many balls?
I had a social life with my friends, you see, before COVID and all of these things happened, and grown-up things happened, you know. And we had those radio awards every now and then that Midlands goes to. So, you know, needed a new outfit.
I'll be heading to that charity shop. So I was going to say, yeah, the great thing about this is that this is a climate action that everybody can take. And it's one that we can put into our lifestyles. So it's just a simple little lifestyle change that we can all make, and we make a big impact on the climate. So if we embrace the circular economy, if we start acting as real agents of change, it's like you say, instead of throwing away those fabrics, if they're unusable and they're very stained and you've got Guinness all down the front of your lovely ball gown, then put it into the proper disposable place. Bring it down to the
clothing bins at your local recycling centre.
Closing banks, yeah. Bring it down to your recycling centre, recycle them properly. But if they can be reused, bring them to a charity shop. Somebody else will find love in them. And if you have an item, say a radio that's broken, try and get it fixed first before just throwing it in the bin and getting another one. If you have an alarm clock, a watch, anything that's digital as well. So being part of the circular economy means you're actually taking direct action to reduce carbon in the environment, and you're being a real agent of change. And that's what we would ask.
I should say as well, Lindsay, that like by both contributing to the stock in these secondhand shops, whether it be an antique or an antique shop or a charity shop, and by purchasing from them, we're supporting the local economy as well. You know, we're keeping people in jobs locally, and that at this point in time is incredibly important. So it's, you know, this circular economy, it's not this airy-fairy idea that politicians are talking about. This is something that actually we can see a tangible benefit from.
Yeah, it's huge. We have to live within our planetary boundaries. We have to move away from the take, make, waste kind of style of business into a more circular way of doing things. But that has a huge benefit everyone across the board. And it really makes a lot of sense. If anything, I hate to use this term because I know how it can sound sometimes. It's just good housekeeping. And it makes sense. It makes sense for our wallet. It makes sense for our jobs. And it makes sense for our country and our environment. So
now,
it's a win-win for everyone.
For instance, we want to pick up, say, maybe home decor, right? And we're, I know a lot of college students will be maybe starting to rent for the first time this autumn, and they might need a few bits and pieces, and you know, we might encourage them to try and go the secondhand route instead of the fast production route. Any tips for people shopping? Like, I know myself, Lindsay, if you're buying anything made out of wood, make sure it doesn't smell of damp. It's always a good pointer, just in case there's anything untoward and you don't want to be bringing home problems. But is there anything else that we should be aware of?
Yeah, so if again, with the wood is a really good point, Aisling. If you see any holes, tiny little dark holes, there would be something in there, like a little animal's burrowing. So we would always say to the people in the shop as well, where did you get your items from? Have they been treated? And things like that. And then, with, you know, lighting, you could always ask in the shop, can you plug it in first to make sure that it works? That's always a really good thing. And then, you know, make a list, stick to your list, go to the different charity shops and ask around, because a lot of the charity shops are friends with each other and they tend to be all congregated together. So where there is one, there is usually more than one shop. And say it to the person who works in the shop, who they're usually volunteers and they're very knowledgeable about what's in the other shops as well. Have they come across something that maybe is on your list to save you time? Which is really good. And then just kind of keep popping in and keep going and don't give up. There's also some really good online stores. So Oxfam have a secondhand furnishing shop as well that I think they're doing online sales in. Depop are really good as well. So if you just type it into Google and secondhand furniture shops as well, you should be able to find some things online there as well.
And we should say that if you're buying anything electrical, and I know electricians will kill me for saying this, but because they're very, very busy at the moment, but just to be on the safe side, it is worth getting it checked out to make sure that the electrics are up to current standards, particularly with an older item. And then for clothing, Lindsay, what are we looking at when we're popping into shops? It's, okay, first of all, we obviously have to like the item and it has to fit. But is there anything else we need to keep our eye out for?
Yeah, so we would say don't shop seasonally. So if you go into your charity shop, you might see a Christmas jumper in May and it might not make sense for you to buy it then. But if you think about it, Christmas jumpers are only ever used once or twice and thrown away. And so you're making a really good climate action by getting that Christmas jumper and bringing it back into the economy and rewearing it. But you're getting a really good bargain as well. And so have a place where you can store these clothing as well at home that might be out of season. Don't just shop in your size. Oversized shirts look really, really good with a little belt. You could always wear a little something that's a little bit smaller, maybe little t-shirts under dresses and things like that. If you see a summer dress, you could always wear a polar neck underneath it. So try and think outside of the seasons as well. And we would always say have a look at the labels because if you go to kind of the posh parts of your neighbourhood, you always find better things in those charity shops too, which is a great tip. But have a look at the labels, and if you have your phone with you, which is really handy, you can Google them. And sometimes these are proper Italian makes and really good high quality labels that you can find in the charity shops.
I know there used to be kind of a little secret in Dublin. I never found out which one it was, but the rumour was there was a particular charity shop somewhere in the city centre that all the RTE staff donated their clothing to. Yeah, I know. I never figured out which one it was, I have to be honest, but I always wanted to find out which one it was. So that's like, it's a fair point. You could be getting huge value for your money. And if there are any college students listening to us today, we're not saying go and spend the month's rent in the charity shop because you got a great bargain. Okay, be responsible as well financially. Just, you know, you still have to feed yourself and house yourself for the next number of weeks. So just, you know, don't lose the plot altogether. But Lindsay, like, it is something that you can have great fun with. Like, I know, like, a lot of my friends, we love popping in an afternoon and then grabbing a coffee and a chat afterwards. But, you know, it's a sociable activity as much as anything else.
You know, it's the smug factor as well, I always say. I could walk into a high street shop and I could buy something that I see on the rack, but I will never get the same pleasure as finding a real bargain and a real steal in a charity shop. Because it's that extra smug, it's that look, that chance, that eye that you've had that have gone into that moment of getting it. So there's a real satisfaction afterwards as well. And it's about setting yourself a personal challenge. So, you know, you can do it in September or you could do it any time of the year, and you can start doing it slowly and then build yourself up. But if you start doing it, you start going on a secondhand journey, I guarantee that the thrill that you get, you know this yourself, Aisling, out of finding something that has value and that you're giving it a new life. And even the imagining of what goes into that, who wore this before me? Where was it going? Did somebody fall in love? Did somebody have their first kiss? You know, and I try to think of all these different stories that go into the clothes as well. And that's just so much more energy in that than walking into a high street shop and buying something.
Like, when we're talking about secondhand September, like, go to your parents' wardrobes, go to your aunts and uncles, go to your grandparents. Like, I will never forget, my late Auntie Carmel was a very, very stylish woman and has possibly the best wardrobe I've ever seen. But I remember going to an awards ceremony when I was working full-time for Midlands, where we actually took home gold, come to think of it. But I had this beautiful dress, but I needed something to cover my shoulders because I don't particularly like my shoulders. And she was like, hold on a second. And she ran upstairs and she had this beautiful stole that I got to borrow for the night and was terrified of getting damaged on the night, I'll be honest. But, like, you know, just to be able to wear something that was belonging to her because she was my godmother, like, it had huge sentimental value for me at the time. And, you know, I really appreciated that connection. Like, what goes around comes around. Fashion in particular is cyclical. And, like, what would have been fashionable maybe in the 80s in our parents' wardrobes or even in the 50s and 60s in our grandparents' wardrobes, you know, that's all back in style now. And people of that generation held on to things. So, you know, you don't necessarily have to spend money. Maybe you might cook dinner as a thank you, or, you know, there could be some bartering arrangement in place.
They're good. And there's a lovely feeling. I wear one, my grandmother's jumper, and she passed about 10 years ago. And the feeling of wearing something that she owned as well, it's a closeness that I didn't have with anything else. And it's very special. So clothes have a lot of meaning, and they have a lot of, and they can be, you know, long lasting if we let them be, and if we cherish them, and if we look at them differently. And I think that we've been programmed to kind of look at fashion maybe in a way that suits the markets, in a way that suits the shops. But like you say, if you just look around you, take a second and start to look at fashion differently, you get a whole different satisfaction.
Well, Lindsay, if we're taking
it,
part in Secondhand September, do we want us to post on social media about it, or how do we spread the word?
That would be fantastic. And if you use the hashtag Secondhand September, and if you need any tips and advice, you can come to our website, voiceireland.org, and we have all of our socials, Voice Ireland, and Oxfam as well is running this campaign, so they've got loads of information
Lindsay O'Connell
there as well.
Of Voice Ireland, thank you very much for joining us on the show this evening. We will be back with some music after the break. Well, I'm afraid that is all we have time for on this week's episode of Let's Go Green. Thank you for listening in. We will be back same time next week with another episode of the show, where we're going to be looking at preschool and how environmentally friendly are our preschools, and what efforts are they making in order to pass on sustainability as an important skill for that particular age group of children. I have an interesting conversation on that particular topic lined up for you next week. But for now, I'd like to thank all the contributors to this week's show. Thanks, of course, to you for listening. It is always appreciated. Don't forget, you can get in contact with the show by emailing me on letsgogreen@midlands103.com, or you can simply contact me through midlands103.com if you search for my name, Aisling O'Rourke. I am going to leave you now with a new piece of Irish music, and it is from Larissa Tormey, who invited me to her album launch last week, which I was only delighted to attend for her new album. And one song in particular stood out for me that has meaning for me, and I hope for you too. So her song, the song that I'm going to play by Larissa, is Dolce Far Niente. It's an Italian phrase known as the art of doing nothing. So I hope you have a safe week and you'll join us again on Let's Go Green. For now, I leave you with Larissa Tormey and Dolce Far Niente.